Bobbig.
Welcome to this BobConf talk. Thanks to the organizers for having me. And it's a pity to have to do this pre-recorded, but I hope it will be as good as the live experience, or at least close. So before I start, I want to manage expectations a little bit. The following talk is anecdotal in nature. So the thing I'm going to be presenting now is not just an idea that I had and haven't tried in practice or anything like this, but it's also not a full fleshed out philosophy that you may be able to directly apply to whatever you're working on. It is a real experience I've had working on a real production system, and I think it's worth sharing. Also, there isn't really, probably not much new ideas there in the sense that there are existing complete fleshed out philosophies of how to design systems out there that this is probably just one aspect of and one variation, and I don't claim novelty. But still, I hope you can take something out of this. So here's the setting. Imagine maybe you're part of a startup. Some visionary founder has a really great and innovative idea for something that the world hasn't seen before. Or maybe you're just reinventing the wheel again, but you have good public relations, so the whole thing flies. And so you as the founder of the startup, maybe you probably have many ideas about how to build the thing. You have some idea for a secret sauce that makes this better than anything else. And you gather a bunch of 10x programmers around you, everyone an expert in whatever field you need to build the thing you want to build. And they're all very excited to build the thing you want to build and contribute to this machinery that makes this great. And they all go out and go off and build this thing. And the whole thing grows and grows as you add features and as you add new ideas. And at some point, you think you're done, and whatever you have grown and built, that's what you ship. Great, well done. But what could happen is that as you build the thing, it kind of grows. And when you're done, whatever shape that thing has, that becomes the interface, the exterior view onto the system or a platform or service that you built. Which means it's defined by how it was built. Maybe the names and types and shape and the functions of the interface kind of reflect the interior workings of the system. And maybe that means that your users will have to understand how the system works in order to use it. But maybe they don't want to. Presumably, they just want to know what your system is, what it does, and how they can use it without needing to know the interior of your machinery. Also, when you build it like this, then maybe the whole behavior of the system, so not just how you interact with it, but also what happens then, is purely defined by how you build it. Now that's implementation defined. And that may be good, but it also means it may be hard to now evolve your system and change it because you don't know what behaviors maybe the users now rely on, which behaviors of the system are just now part of the contract with your users, so to say. So all in all, clearly not so very satisfying. And at my previous job, I think we were at risk of doing precisely that. So what we were building is what I would describe as a decentralized serverless service hosting platform. So from the user's point of view, or the developer's point of view, you can create services, you build them in a language that compiles to WebAssembly, which is this nice container or nice abstract format for compiled code that can run in a sandbox very nicely. You upload that to the platform, and then it can interact with the outside world and also with other services on the platform using asynchronous messaging. So there were quite a few things we were building that didn't exist in this particular format before. And at some point, I vaguely remember that the team building the system component that passes messages between these services and between the shards and whatever that means, they were claiming we can now support messages between services. And we didn't even have an inkling of how these services would send messages or receive messages or how the outside would send messages to and from the system. My impression was that we were at risk of treating the public interface of the whole system is an afterthought to implementation. And we were building it without knowing whether it makes sense end to end, whether it's usable, whether it's understandable for our developers. And in a very abstract sense, we were building it without knowing what it is. Furthermore, we had other people in that were supposed to build on top of the platform that we're building. They were building tooling, development kits that compile to this kind of service module. We even built a new programming language. That's how I ended up in that place. And of course, these developers, they need to know the interface of the system and how it behaves. But if we're just building it from the inside out and then define the interface by accident, more or less, and then build on top of it, then we have a very long critical path. So we could not start building on top of features before they were completely implemented. And that could be improved. So at that point, I started making a little fuss and annoyed the relevant people enough to let me go ahead with this idea that I proposed of nailing down the public specification. And the idea that I behind this is that we should think of the system from the outside. So for a moment, let's try to completely forget all the clever implementation tricks and focus on the what, not the how of the system. So what do your users need to know about the system? Okay, so surely the concrete interface. So for a network service, that might be the wire protocol, like the bytes on which order and what they mean, everything. For web service, might be the REST endpoints and arguments and results. For library, it would be the function names and function signatures. But the interface isn't enough. The users also need to know what it means to call a certain function, to invoke a certain entry point, how they interact with each other, how time plays into play here. So fundamentally, what the semantics of the system is. So how do we describe the semantics? Isn't this already the how question? Like, how does the whole thing behave? The best question, maybe best answered by implementation? Well, as I said, that you can do that. That's possible. But then you have an implementation defined system. And maybe sometimes that's fine. But sometimes I think we can do better. And the idea is that you only describe what's really relevant to the user to use your system and ignore as much as possible of the stuff that the user doesn't care about. There are different forms that specification can take. So it could be just a bunch of text, a bunch of prose describing how the system behaves, and that's a good start, of course. Or you could try to be more formal and describe the behavior of your system with mathematical precision, or at least some approximation thereof. Some pragmatism is probably always needed. So you could do it by starting to describe the state of the system with mathematical notation, like sets, maps, relations, lists, all of these. But describe the abstract state. So not necessarily how your file system internally stores the data that the user gives you, but rather what is the mental model of that? And in the end, you get a document that is, in principle, everything a user or a developer needs to interact with your system. Everything they need to know should be in there, from the very concrete details of the interface, how to encode the messages, what is the parameter list of a certain function, and so on, but also what it means to use them, how do they interact, what are the preconditions, what are the failure conditions, and so on. And conversely, anything that is not in the document, anything that the user does not need to care about should not be in the document. All the things you do in the behind the scenes, things you do about crash recovery, decentralization, performance, scaling, security, access control maybe, and for administrative purposes, logging, whatever. All the things that make your product great because it works so good, but doesn't really affect the raw essence of what it means to be your product, they should be out of this document. So this was the idea that I set out to establish, and I After enough nagging, I got some encouragement, and I set out and I wrote this that specification document for our system. It was actually initially called the public spec, because not because the document was public, because at that time it wasn't public, but because it describes just the public, the external view onto the system. It has been published since. It's now called the interface spec, because the public spec was too confusing. But I find that name still a little bit misleading, because it's not just the interface, if you think of interface as a list of functions and methods, because it also contains the semantics. And in this document, I actually described the semantics twice. So there's a prose-oriented section that describes in but still very technical, but accessible way, or the entry points or the methods, and then with prose describes what these things do. So it looks like a reference document manual maybe. And then there's also a separate section, which is more rigorous and more mathematical. So there I start describing the state of the system as an abstract mathematical object. So it has a bunch of fields, and each field is a map or a set or a list. And of course, this is not the state that you would see in production, because production, that's distributed, there's a lot of other stuff going on. But really, this is what we think all that a user ideally should need to know and think about when interacting with the system. And I think already this section makes the work on a document like this worthwhile, because you're really nailing down a abstract, more conceptual model of your system that separates the what from the how of the implementation details. And once you've described the state of the system in that way, you can, for every for every function call, for every entry point, for everything that interacts with the system, either from the outside or maybe from inside, from one of these services, you can now say how the state gets transformed. And that could either be a function that takes the old state and returns the new state, if you want to do it more functional programming, or it could be a predicate that describes if the state before had these properties, afterwards it has these properties, which is actually quite versatile, because it means you can easily describe non-determinism or under-specification. Because you want the specification to describe the behavior with enough detail to make sense for the user, but probably you don't want to over-constrain it in the sense that the implementation might have to make certain choices about scheduling of different events, because of distribution things might happen, there might be resource limits, there might be failure, and all of these things allow the system, one implementation of the specification to maybe vary a little bit within clearly defined bounds in how they behave. And a modeling using a mathematical idea of the state, but then a relational description of the state changes actually works quite well. So the document grew quite a lot. That was is now almost a book. It actually is a book, because when I left, a colleague actually printed it as a book, which I found very, very nice. Thanks, Hans. And it's certainly not the most accessible document. But it doesn't have to be. So it's not meant to be a tutorial for somebody working with this ecosystem for the first time to fully understand everything, because it's also not a place for, I think it's not a place for long justification, long design decision, history, a place where you would document alternative ways of how you could do things and describe why they were done like this. So I tried to keep it very concise and precise and a reference manual for people who mostly know it already, but they need to have it written down somewhere. And even with that restriction, it still grows, because these systems just become very complex over time, even when they claim to be very simple. I wrote this document in a text-based markup language. We used AsciiDoc, because we used it elsewhere. And the point is, for that, is you can actually treat it like code. You put it in a Git repository, and then you make changes, you make pull requests, and you can review them. And this allows you to have a engineer compatible model of communicating around this thing. And actually, as I said earlier, we have people building the thing from the inside, and we have people building on top of the whole thing, and we have the interface in between. And by introducing this document and also the repository around it and a workflow where new features will be fleshed out by describing their changes to the interface separately from thinking about how to actually implement them, we created a forum where the people can come together that use the interface from both sides, the people building it and the people using it. And they could now argue and discuss and debate and refine and improve on more or less equal footing. And I think this also helps a lot to build a nice interface and build a system that has a nice exterior view. Because otherwise you might fall prey to conveyed laws, which says that your software always looks a bit like your organizational structure. And more concretely, I observed, I mean, it's not very surprising, there's always a tendency to push complexity into other layers of your system. So if the people building the system, the implementation, get to define the interface, they're more likely to push complexity across the border to the other team. And maybe build interfaces very low level, that may be very much tailored around how they actually build things internally. And it may end up being hard to use or tricky to use, or it may not be abstract enough to stay the same interface as the interface changes and evolves. So by looking at the interface on its own and discussing changes there, you have a better chance of thinking, couldn't we phrase it like this? And then if we ever do this particular feature, then we don't have to change the interface. As you could imagine, it took a little while to anchor this document and the process around it in the organization. I think it stays a continuous struggle to keep everyone on board, because of course this kind of slows things down. If you just get like, you know, somebody from higher up tells you, now do this, we need to get this done in 2 weeks. And now you have to sit and write a document and discuss with people who get to use the feature first how this actually should look like and then get to implement it. Yes, it slows things down a little bit. And there's always the risk that this kind of will fall on the wayside and people will just fall back to just building new features and maybe later update the specification document with what they have actually built. And then it just becomes documentation. And this risk exists, and in order to counterpoint it a little bit, I at some point later suggested that we maybe should invest into a reference implementation to make it more concrete. So what does this mean? So the idea behind the reference implementation is you take the specification document and then you build the most simple, most elegant, and most direct implementation that actually fulfills the specification without looking at the concrete production implementation. So you're basically like clean room re-implementation, and you make it as simple as possible. So you ignore everything you can ignore while still sticking to the specification. You ignore performance, reliability, scalability, persistence, crash recovery, distribution, security, all of the things that make your production system great, you can just ignore. But you still want to fulfill the whole specification, not just build a model of it, but really fulfill it, including the concrete interfaces, so that suddenly now you have two implementations of your system, or of the idea of your system, of your specification. And both are kind of real enough to be used by the tools and libraries and programs that build on top of your platform. So not only the people building these tools can now test against both production and reference implementation. And everything that something doesn't quite work, you can now compare behaviors, and this will hopefully turn on all the spots where the production system is not behaving as the specification. So every time there's a difference in behavior, it's either a bug in one of the two implementations and you can track it down, or maybe it's just a bad formulation in the spec and then can fix that. So this really helps to keep the production expectation honest and close to the spec. And when writing this rough implementation, my suggestion is to really resist the urge to share code with the production implementation. Because once you share code, any kind of bug or misbehavior that is in the shared code will not show up. And a good way to do that is, of course, to use a very different programming languages. So we used Rust in the production implementation, and then when I set out to build the Haskell, the Rust implementation, I used Haskell. We had the spec maybe for half a year, and things were going okay, but not great with like sticking to the spec. So I just did this thing. I sat down and re-implemented the whole spec in Haskell. And Haskell is great because it's really, I mean, you've heard this probably a few times before, it's really great for rapid prototype. I could alone in a few days implement the spec as it was at that time, and it was actually working compatible with the systems that were building on top of our system. There are plenty of libraries to use, so all the plumbing I needed to do for the interfaces, like HTTP, CBOR, crypto, WebAssembly stuff, I could just use libraries for, so this was great. And then because it's a very high-level language, I was able to mostly separate the plumbing code, so the code that deals with file formats and networking and these things, from code that ideally in a very high-level way reflects the specification and just the specification. So ideally, it should just read like the specification document, or at least the mathematical part of it. And well, now that we had the teams that were building on top of the platform, now they could use two separate implementations in the test suite, and this helped to find bugs. It also just gave them more confidence in complaining when the implementation didn't match the spec, because they could say, well, with your test, it passes here, it doesn't pass with your code, please fix it. And previously, it was more like, well, look at this document there that somebody wrote, but maybe it's not up to date, and so on and so on. Okay, and now that we started writing code around the spec, we can actually go one step further and write a what could be called a specification acceptance test suite. Again, this is code written with just specification in mind, but now it sits on the other side of the interface. And it uses the system according to the interface and probes it in all the various ways to see if it actually behaves like the interface describes. And again, we have benefits of using an expressive language like Haskell with maybe good testing libraries. So we can do extensive fuzzing, we can do property-based testing, we can do just very quickly describe many different test cases because it's a rapid programming language. And because the test suite is based on the specification and not the actual implementation, it is compatible with both implementations we have, the production implementation and the reference implementation. So we can use the test suite to test the reference implementation, which is already useful because it's not much fun to write code without being able to test it easily and in isolation. And then the test suite can also be used to test the production implementation and maybe should be part of the CI system for the production so that you continuously check that you're still satisfying the spec in at least those ways that you could map and express in the test suite. And then in the end, you have these two specification-derived artifacts, the reference implementation, the reference test suite, they can test each other, and they can test the production implementation and the production tooling on top of the system, so like crosswise. And this gives a very nice confidence in that really everything you build is nicely built around the spec. So in my case, the test suite ended up being quite substantial, more than 400 individual tests. And indeed, it was very great to use Haskell there because just one or two lines of tests could easily express something that in the previous tests we were writing, maybe with Rust, were 10 lines or 15. And one thing I'm particularly proud of is that I introduced what I call the universal service. So one problem with testing a system like this is that for many kind of test steps you want to interact from the outset with the system, and then in the system there is some kind of service running and it needs to send another message to another service and then comes back and then responds, and some complex interaction involving both the outside and services on the platform. And if you just do it pedestrian-wise, you have to program these services individually using languages you have available, and actually very early we were partly writing them by hand in raw WebAssembly. This is like almost writing machine, well, not quite machine code, but it's very tedious. So it doesn't scale. It's a lot of work for a simple test that maybe just sends a message back and forth. So what I did instead is I wrote a simple canister that implements a very simple programming language that can instruct the canister, or sorry, the service to perform certain steps in sequence. And it takes the steps to perform from the message it receives from the outside. So I can write a test that sits on the outside and then sends a message into one of these services. And the message contains some bytes that tell the service what to do, send another service, which again sends another message, which again tells that service what to do, or maybe respond, and all the other things a service could do on our platform. And then I embed this in my Haskell test suite by a simple DSL that allows me to describe in Haskell both the behavior of the test runner outside and completely transparently in one line and no separation what happens on the service. And then under the hood, it takes this DSL, creates a very simple script language out of it, passes it in a message to the service, and the service executes it. It's actually simpler than it sounds. But it was very productive because now complex interactions are just 1, 2, 3 lines of Haskell that I don't know how we could effectively do otherwise. So this is roughly as far as I were able to push this development model in practice. If you want to go further, there are some ideas of things that I would want to do but didn't manage to do. So at some point I was hoping that the reference implementation, you know, the nice, carefully polished abstract Haskell code that I wrote, could be the specification. That I could take parts of that code, the relevant code in the non-plumbing modules, and include it in the specification document, just the way I include this kind of ad hoc pseudo math right now. And I think if with a little bit more effort, and care, this might be possible. It might be more likely possible in a language that gives you more control over syntax, because you want this not to look like Haskell, because not everybody likes reading code that looks like Haskell. You want it to look like pseudocode that any reader is supposed to at least make some sense of. And languages like ACTA with the mixfix syntax, or maybe Isabel with this very flexible way of pretty printing the code in LaTeX and allowing you to replace certain definitions with actual LaTeX macros might actually be a way of getting a very nice output there. For Haskell, I think the main reason why I gave up was that record syntax is just ugly, especially a nested record update in Haskell is not a simple one-line thing. So you either need lenses and then you have these operators that are not obvious for non-lens developers, or you have these manually written nested record updates and then it's not pretty. And then clearly a more ambitious goal would be to take the artifacts that we described above, so the specification with its mathematical or pseudomath content, the reference implementation, the reference test suite, maybe even the production implementation, and then connect them all using formal methods. And in the end, have a formally verified implementation of the whole system. Now, this kind of extreme goal, that's something you can do if it's like a big research project or a very big commercial thing. Like things like SEL4 and CompSA, they have done that, but it's still out of reach if you just want to build a thing and ship it. But it's a spectrum. You could start maybe taking the math in the document by hand, translating it into a theorem prover, so you have a formalized model of your system, and then prove certain core properties about your system, maybe some safety properties that this canister cannot change the code of the memory of the canisters are our services. This service cannot change the code of that service over there, or stuff like that. At some point, I even managed to take the Haskell code from my reference implementation and convert it into Coq code so that I could load it in Coq and could start proving things formally about it. So this would be one way of obtaining a formal model without having to write it again. Just take the reference implementation code and convert it into a system where you can do formal reasoning. But then I didn't really get to do much with it, and the code has grown a lot since then because the system grows. So yeah, the practicalities of getting something shipped seem to be hard to getting in the way of doing these kind of formal proofs. And it's a pity, because if I could have ticked off that book, sorry, if I could have ticked off that box, then what I've just described would almost completely fulfill the requirements for a deep specification as termed by the DeepSpec project. The DeepSpec project was a large research project in the US with a few Ivy League universities thinking about how we can make these kind of software specifications better and how to integrate formal methods. And they have four requirements they have for a specification to be what they call max, or to be maximally useful in their opinion. So it needs to be rich. So rich means it's not just the interface, but it also describes the complex behaviors of the system. And in a way we have that. Our specification document describes how the system interacts upon certain messages and interactions. The specification would be two-sided, meaning connecting both implementation and clients. And in a way, I could argue we have that because we have not just the reference implementation built in the spec, but also the test suite that deals with the spec from the outside. Has to be formal, written with proper mathematical notation. And we're halfway there, so we have this mathematical notation, but it's kind of ad hoc. It's just on paper. It's not something that a tool can consume to make things with it, like formal reasoning or generating code from it or stuff like that. So here we are falling a bit short. And then the fourth requirement is needs to be live. And live means executable, and we have that in a way because we have the specification not just on dead paper, but also as an executable reference implementation. But they also require live to be connected by formal proofs to the implementation. And of course, this is a big gap that we have where we have these testing mechanisms and reference tests and everything, but still whether the implementation actually matches the spec and therefore fulfills the properties that we could prove about the specification is not connected because it's still missing this formal proof stuff. All right, as I mentioned in the beginning, little of what I said here is really new. So if you want to maybe read something more structured about a methodology based on something like this, certain terms you can look for are consumer-driven contract testing, specification by example, domain-driven design, and there's actually a nice talk about Nicole Rauch's idea of functional essence, which also is quite similar to what I described here. So what can you take home from this talk? I think the most important takeaway is that as you design and build a system or a service or something like this, try to picture it from the outside. Create a mental model that is independent of the interior of your system, of the implementation, and is more abstract. And then build your system from the inside out to fill this abstract vision, rather than the other way around of building first and then looking at what you have. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm looking forward to a lively and live Q&A session.